Thank you for joining us on this episode of Eminent Teachnology with Dr. Rochelle Newton and Drew Stennett, where we examine current and emerging technologies through the lens of diversity and equality.
Okay, I think we're good. All the lights look green anyway, so I assume that will be good. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Eminent Teachnology. We have a special guest with us today. His name is Andy Ingham, and we're actually going to talk about like a bunch of stuff, Andy. I have many different topics.
Fantastic. Hopefully I'll have some good things to say about some of them.
Yes. Yes. As is Rochelle. And when we were talking beforehand about like, oh, what, I wonder what Andy wants to talk about. And I think we all had sort of like different ideas on cool Andy things.
Okay. So I'm game.
The thing that, I wanted to ask you about first was, so you used to be a librarian, which always sort of throws me for a loop because I'm like, oh, Andy, he's like a Linux administrator. He does data stuff. Like, what's up with that? What's up with being a librarian?
Well, it's funny. It's funny you ask because, you know, I spent 13 years in a librarian role and I'm not sure I ever once interacted with books directly. So, you know, I think people have this notion, rightly so, of librarians as, you know, dealing with books all day. And I certainly didn't. I was a systems librarian. And so, you know, we were focused on the IT infrastructure for the library, you know, the online catalog system, as well as sort of the, you know, supporting websites as well as, you know, workstations and stuff, that general IT stuff for the library.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I hadn't really thought about what being a librarian really, really meant. And I was like, I know Andy wasn't like sitting behind a desk, like stamping books, which is sort of like, you know, the...
Right. Or shushing people. Right. That's the other thing that people always associate with librarians. And, you know, certainly in 2020, and I've been away from it for almost a decade now, but certainly in 2020, 2021, it's all about data and, you know, online access to resources. Although for certain disciplines in particular, there's still a need for, you know, access to primary materials and physical items, but a lot of it is online information now, certainly.
What sort of stuff do you see as still like needing that physical touching of books? Like,
sure. Well, I mean, you think about the entire history of human knowledge up until very recently, the way it was conveyed was in print form. And while many things have been digitized, there are all sorts of things that never have and may not be. You know, that gets smaller and smaller as time goes on because certain things are digitized over time. But I would say it tends to be those things that are more primary source materials, like, you know, manuscripts or diaries or things like that, that are very specific. And in a lot of cases were never even published, right?
Yeah.
So those sorts of things.
Primarily. That's interesting. The, like a whole, like growing up thinking of libraries and books, like I never really considered them data, but really that really is all a library is, right? It's like a big store for data. Was it easy? And when you were doing, I want to say library stuff, but I don't even know if that's the right way to say it. I mean, you were doing data stuff for a library. Is that?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's fairly accurate. Yeah. I was mostly involved with the website and the sort of cataloging and display of electronic resources for the library. So in that way, it was sort of metadata about resources.
Okay.
But the one thing that I think is kind of interesting is that there's a long history in librarianship about of sort of wanting information to be free and yes. free in terms of freely available. Right. And now I find myself working with all sorts of data that has to be protected in certain ways. So in a lot of ways, it's very different from that. Right.
Yes.
In
yes.
a fundamental sort of way.
Was it hard to transition between those two? Like, I know for me, a lot of times it's sort of a weird dichotomy. It's like, because everybody wants information to be free, like you mentioned, like freely available. But at the same time, when you need more secure things, they can't be free or they can't be easily accessible. And like, I think drawing that line is hard because a lot of, to me, it seems like a lot of technology people say, hey, I'm going to make something cool, but I don't really want anybody to look at it. I'm going to keep it sort of to myself. You know, people just should not worry about it. Where I think it would be helpful if, you know, more people did the opposite. But if you're giving your information out, then it's less secure. And, you know, well, that could be argued, I guess, but.
Right. Certainly less private or confidential.
Just jump in here. And I'm sorry, Andy, but you know, I think that for one, Drew, technology, like if you look at most higher ed, they have a direct link to technology. So mm-hmm. like if you look at the Duke Law, we fell up under the library director. We did not report to finance or some other department. We reported to the library director. And in a lot
of instances, I didn't know that.
A lot of instances that makes more sense than it does for the technology report people to report to some other organization, because in a lot of ways, what you're doing, as Andy has said, and I think you referenced as well, it's like you are either providing or securing data, either one. So if you're a technologist, just in general, you are typically managing and manipulating and massaging data to come up with an outcome. Well, so are librarians, but in a very different way. So, you know, they are the keepers of, if you will, the canonical source of information, right? So, you know, like when we talk about blockchain or Bitcoin and all those things, we think about an immutable ledger. Well, in a lot of ways, a library is that same thing. So a library has the first iteration of a document that's produced. So let's just say the Constitution. So the very first place it goes is to a library. And then every time it's modified, they just keep adding and adding and adding. And that original source becomes what Andy was talking about, those things that are still tangible, right? You can reach out and touch them because a lot of people want that. But then a lot of people, you know, it's how you learn, right? So some people need to read a book, a podcast or Audible book or something is not as great as being able to write your notes in there or make information in a digital source, whereas in a library I can annotate, I can say when I read it, yeah. But that's not always the case with that. But I will say one of the things that I think Andy, you know, really brings to this game is like, so to have been in both sides, right? So like if you are going to go work in a library, they ask you for an IS degree or some kind of degree in there. And so what's really interesting, very few people cross over. So either you're a technologist or you're a librarian, even a technical librarian, very few cross over the platform. And I think that's really what's phenomenal about what Andy just said, how he's gone from the library side and cataloging, which is very interesting, to the other side, which is securing data.
Yeah.
Well, thanks. Yeah. Well, the one thing I was going to say in sort of reference to your mentioning the Constitution as an example, right? One of the three legs of the IT security stool is data integrity, right? And so, and it seems more important than ever, given, you know, the last few years of misinformation and those sorts of things, that it's critically important to make sure that, as you say, there is a canonical record of what is actually real. And you know, the way in which it travels through time and whether or not it changes, and if so, how, and is that appropriate that it changes?
That's really interesting. So what are the, you said that's one of the legs, what are the other two, and why is this a three-legged stool? That doesn't, should we have a fourth leg on there?
It's an excellent question. I have seen some things that talk about a fourth leg, but generally speaking, it's thought of as confidentiality, integrity, and availability. So CIA is the way to remember it. And nice. That's the third one there. Availability is also sort of important on, you know, in terms of things being freely available, as we said before, it's critically important even that confidential data is freely available to the people it's supposed to be available to, right? It needs to be available in those contexts. And if you lock things down so much that even the people who are supposed to have access to things don't, then, right, you're negating one of the important aspects of security, the availability of the data.
Yeah.
I will say one thing. So if you think about libraries in the history of print, right? So if you go back to the printing press and all those things, for a lot of time, especially poor or less intelligent people didn't always have access to data. So one of the things that the libraries have done is to make sure that they remain a source of information for anybody who wants. Now, what type of data, that's different. But if you go into a public library, a university library, most university libraries are open to the public. They're not just open to people who belong to that university or whatever. They're open to the public because information needs to be available to everyone. For so long in the history of European society and other societies, that they limited who had access to. So whether you had education, whether you had the right name, right credentials, right money, whatever it is, you could get access to money. But people who did not were not. So what libraries have really been really successful at doing is making sure that everyone who wants information has access to the information that they can give. Now, of course, you know, libraries have things like reserves and documents that have been, you know, stored over time and are more prehistoric or older. They try to put those in a place where you can't just walk up and pick it off a shelf and start reading it. But there is a lot to be said for what a library brings to the equation. And if you look at the model of data governance, it's based on the library model of data governance.
That's really cool.
Well, knowledge is power, right? And it truly is. And as you're saying, you know, the more you can make that available equitably to a wide range, you know, essentially anybody, that's a pretty important and powerful thing in terms of providing some power to marginalized groups, right? It's critically important.
And a lot of times marginalized groups does not necessarily mean ethnicity, but more economics than anything, because typically information is often hardest to come by for those who are least able to afford it, where it should be free to those they are least able to access.
Right. What concerns me a little bit about the digital age is just the fact that there starts to open up a widening gulf based on the fact that since everything is electronic, you have to have the means to access things electronically. And in cases where, internet coverage is spotty or that it's cost prohibitive for people, it increases barriers for access to information because all of it is electronic.
Yeah. And I think one of the really interesting pieces about that is, like, you know, in one way, we're saving trees, right? So we don't cut down and destroy as many forests because we don't have to print everything. But then the other side of that is what happens to that information, you know? So what happens when a book ages out? Maybe you could tell us in a library, typically what, so my experience is maybe a little bit different than yours, but typically when a book ages out, what do you normally do?
You're asking from the library context, what would you do?
Yeah.
I mean, it depends, right? The whole collection development life cycle is a specialty in librarianship, and it involves not just developing the collection on the front end in terms of deciding which materials to acquire, but also, you know, when to retire things or which things to retire. In any significantly sized academic library, I don't know what the percentage is, but it's a pretty high percentage. I would guess maybe 95% of the physical materials never circulate, literally never circulate. So it's not a question of, things wearing out. They might, disintegrate over time just because, things age. But it typically isn't because they've gotten used to the point where they're falling apart. Again, that has to do with large libraries because they have so many volumes, right? And they get so specialized on things that there are just very few people that want access to any given specific thing, right?
Yeah.
I want to make one reference to materials, right? So in the instance where a book has been replaced, a lot of times you go to a book and you'll see it's been copyrighted many years. Some copyrights expire, if you will, and specifically depending on what kind of copyright it is, right? So this is the digital commons or something else. It may or may not have a life or a length of time, but when the publisher or the person who originally made the document, the book or whatever is available, they will reissue a new copyright. And maybe it's a new laws in the copyright that the original law didn't include, whatever, and they'll keep adding that. So in the instance of data, how do you keep that same freshness of the data? So you go back and look at who should have access to the data, whether the data should be publicly available, you know, do we, what are the crossroads of limiting who has access to that data? What are the things this that way? And so in the library sense, you limit people who are most, may be most fragile in the economic sphere of access to data. But how does that, I mean, in the book, but how does that work in the data world?
I think it varies, right? If there's a clear owner of the data, then that entity is what decides how the data can be used and who can have access to it and so on. And oftentimes it's based on a data use agreement, which is, you know, a legal contract that entities enter into agreeing to use certain data for a certain length of time under certain conditions for a certain purpose, those sorts of things. It blurs, though, for certain kinds of data that is readily available sort of publicly already. And, you know, I've run into this a few times with research projects that want to use Twitter data, for example. And, you know, on the one side, it's public data by the simple fact that, right, people choose to put tweets out there and, you know, it's available. But that doesn't stop Twitter from having a terms of use in terms of how you're able to collect that data. And they do that mostly so that their systems aren't overrun by people harvesting data and things like that. And also there's, rightly or wrongly, I think people expect that those sorts of things are transient, especially in cases where, you know, people delete tweets, right? The reality, though, and it's what you always, you know, tell your teenagers, as soon as something is put out there, you should assume that it's out there forevermore, because somebody's going to capture it at some point and stow it away somewhere. And even if you delete that tweet, trust me when I tell you, it's available somewhere, right?
Yes.
So I don't know if that answers your question, but...
I thought that was interesting with the Parler stuff recently, where people would delete their posts, but they weren't, I mean, they weren't deleted at all. They were just like marked as do not link to, like, right. 100%. They were all like totally there. If you put the right URL in, it's just, it's not quite as visible as it used to be.
Absolutely.
Right.
So one other thing that I wanted to talk with you about, Andy, is, and I think this is when we were first talking about having you on the podcast, you were eating carrots for lunch.
I wondered if this would come up.
Yes. And I felt with, so right now, like everybody's working from home, exercising is like, at least for me, it has been much harder to do, and eating right too, because like when I think about eating lunch, I'm like, okay, I've been sitting here all day. I want to eat like a hot dog and some potato chips and, you know, maybe go for like a short walk. But I'm curious how you specifically, like, how do you stay motivated to eat well? And how do you stay motivated to exercise?
excellent questions. And the premise of that is that I am staying motivated to do those things. And I'm not sure necessarily that that's true.
Let's say more motivated than at least one of us on the call.
Both of us.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I think as much as anything, you know, I'm a creature of habit, and you know, I sort of gotten used to certain things like that, routines and stuff, and I have found that it's easier for me if I try to maintain some semblance of a routine, and that includes even, you know, what I buy at the store and what I eat at various times. I also find that I just feel better if, you know, I'm eating well and trying to exercise regularly. I will say that just the sort of ambient exercise that people get for no other reason than walking to and from their car, you know, walking from the car to work, fairly small amounts, but it's more than a lot of us are getting now because we're just at home.
Yeah.
I also have purposely continued to stand most of the day instead of sitting. And, you know, I have done that for 15 or 20 years at the office, and I am doing it now at home as well. Yeah. It's a challenge for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
But let me just add, don't get old. Because once you get old, all of that logic about exercise and staying in shape goes completely. Okay. My bones are hurting. It's raining. It's cold outside. I can barely walk. What? You want to do exercise? Okay. Let's lie down. We will talk about it after we wake up from our nap.
Yeah.
I hear you.
Even today, like I went out for a walk at lunch and I was just like, it's freezing. It's cloudy. Like, I just want to like get out and back in. Like, I just cannot get that motivation to keep it up.
Well, and it's easier to do that now because you don't have something that's required of you to actually make it to a certain place or those sorts of things. Right.
Oh yeah.
And this time of year is incredibly difficult. I find sort of across the board.
Yeah.
But one of the things I think that we touched on when I was eating carrots for lunch that one day was just the sort of, you know, I've tried to think more about white privilege, you know, over the last year or so, a couple of years. And I had mentioned that I thought that it had occurred to me that there were a number of ways in which I enjoy white privilege without necessarily having thought about it before. Things like, you know, I run in the dark sometimes in the morning, especially during the wintertime, just run early. And some of that comes from the fact that I live in a safe neighborhood and, you know, there are plenty of people who don't. I have access to, you know, a wide array of healthy food. And there are plenty of food deserts where people just don't have access to that, those things, right? And, you know, we're talking about working from home. We may lose sight of the fact that there are all sorts of folks who can't work from home. And they're sort of on the front lines. And in many situations, you know, are in low wage jobs. And, you know, so, and because of that, they're exposed in ways that I'm not. So it's important to remember those things that you may just take for granted.
So what is white privilege?
What is white privilege?
Yeah.
Put me on the spot there for a definition, huh?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I would say it's the ability to not have to think about certain things, again, because you take them for granted, because they're just readily available to you. And you don't even think about the fact that that isn't the case for a lot of people. Just basics like, you know, adequate housing, livable neighborhoods, healthy food, drinkable water. I mean, talk about, you know, Flint, Michigan, for example. And when you live in a certain tunnel of space-time where you aren't interacting with a wide range of people who aren't in the same socioeconomic situation you are, you forget that those situations exist. And one of the things that I've taken to doing over the last year is volunteering with Meals on Wheels in Durham. And, you know, I do it once or twice a month. I don't do it every week. I'm sort of a utility infielder when one of their delivery drivers, you know, can't do their shift that week. But nice. Part of what I enjoy about it is the reminder that people live in incredibly difficult situations, and you can't be blind to that. And it's very painful sometimes and frustrating and, you know, to see the way people are forced to live. And the fact that in a country as wealthy as this one, that there are so many people who just struggle so mightily. But it's important not to lose sight of it.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing about white privilege, at least in my mind, is that there is such a concept. I don't know that white privilege exists, but that there is such a concept. I mean, just like white supremacy, you know, like what exactly, who came up with these things? Who thought this was something to define? You know, elitism, you know, you've got all these words that infer better than someone else. And I think that in a lot of ways, one of the places where this is really, it stands out is pay, right? So white men are at the top of the food chain, same education, same experience, they're still at the top of the food chain. White women make 80 cents for every dollar a white man makes. Where's the white privilege or the white supremacy there? I don't know the answer to that question, but there's so many places you could expand this, right? And so what does it mean to have pay disparities, right? So if you have a daughter, a wife, a sister, a mother, whatever it is, and that person makes less than her male colleague somewhere, does that not say something about privilege as a whole? Like, is it just better to be a white male than it is to be anything else? Does white supremacy or white privilege fall into that packaging?
Yeah, I mean, what I would say is that white privilege, I think of white privilege in terms of being descriptive. It's not something that I think is good. I mean, I don't think it ought to be the case, but it's something that we have to acknowledge exists. And if that phrase is a good phrase, so be it. If it's not, we should come up with a different one. But for me anyway, I think it's pretty clear that it's real. However you call it, the reality is that whites and white males in particular enjoy certain things that others don't, right? And it's not, we're saying it should be that way. We're just describing the fact that it is, right?
Yeah, I feel like the system is sort of rigged towards white males the way it is now. And that just sort of like self-perpetuates itself. Like, it's something that needs to be fixed. But, you know, it's one of those sort of hard things where I think I've talked about this before. Like, traditionally, I've worked in tech as a white male with other white men. And then when I think about, you know, like who I want to work with, I think of people that I've worked with in the past before that are white men. And being able to, you know, switch tracks and be like, oh, you know, I think that's where that being aware of that privilege comes in, is saying, hey, recognize this thing that's not necessarily good and try and make corrections.
Right.
I think the term for that was old boys network. And then you have the new term, which is homosocial reproduction. I prefer to be with people like me. The problem with that is look at all the people you exclude, because not only now have you excluded the Black and brown people, but you've excluded the women, you've excluded handicapped people, you've excluded so many people by making that decision. And, you know, maybe those relationships work really well. You work well with people that you work with before who are like you in trait, but what do you learn when you work with people that are not? Did that experience not, is that uncomfortable, or is that something that you don't feel comfortable working with people that are not like you?
And I don't think it's I don't think it has to do with comfort at all. I think it's just it's what people are used to. So maybe that is a comfort thing. Something familiarity. That really, I'm sorry.
Familiarity.
Yeah. Yeah. I was listening to Jon Stewart in an interview where he was talking about how when he was working at The Daily Show, they were coming under fire for people were saying that their jokes were sexist. And he said he looked around the room and was like, you know, we're a bunch of like hashtag woke men. Like, how can people think that we're sexist, right? Like Bill and John and Steve and like, oh, well, there's no other like women in here to... You know, of course we're sexist. We're a bunch of men. And it's like, oh, well, yeah, that's like, it's hard to see until you look for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in terms of how you fix it, or not even fix it, but improve things as time goes on, it's incredibly hard to even know or know where to start, you know? And I think it's so entrenched in so many ways from, you know, where people have been allowed to live, what educational opportunities people have, what employment opportunities people have, which is also related to, you know, educational opportunities and those sorts of things. It's just so stacked against so many people. How do you fix those foundational things, right? Even with the best intentions, it's hard to know where to start.
I agree. I think one of the interesting pieces about this discussion, and I was talking to Drew about this earlier, you could talk about diversity till you're 170 million years old and you still be in the exact same place, because it is such a hard nut to crack. But I think that there are so many other constructs that you could link in there, right? So ageism, sexism, genderism, and all the other things that you could just kind of say, you know, like, we just don't like anybody but ourselves. We don't like anybody who doesn't think like us or doesn't believe like us or doesn't share the same amount of whatever it is. I think that as you said, being woke, you know, like that has taken on a new connotation, because what does that mean? If you're aware and you don't do anything, are you woke? You know, if you are aware and you speak about it, are you woke? You know, what does that mean? You know, and I think that there's so much to unpack. You know, you've got people that are hungry, you've got people that are, you know, have not completed full education to participate fully in the capitalistic society we have people that are not educated correctly. You've got, you know, a high number of people that do not have a lot of education in prison. You know, you've got so many things the system is in place for. But I think if you go back and look at our society, just in American society, we don't have to go look at what's across the river, but In a way, we have created this place, right? So we made the right to vote a legal act. We made integration a legal action. We made poverty a crime. We made housing a crime, or redlining so that you didn't want certain people to live in your neighborhood because they were going to bring the neighborhood down, or whatever it is we believe. Like, that's so much stuff to think about what we did literally. And I will just say one thing across the river. If you read the Adolf Hitler stuff that happened before World War II, he based German superiority on Jim Crow and slavery. That's deep. That's pretty hard to even wrap your mind around. We gave someone else the tools to come up with the extinction of Jews and things like that based on an arcane wrong system in America. Yeah.
That's crazy.
Well,
it's crazy.
What's shocking to me, and perhaps it shouldn't have been, but I think it's probably true for others, that the last few years have been a real eye-opener in terms of things that, you know, may be obvious to disadvantaged populations, but for white guys like me to realize that in so many ways we've made very little progress in 50 years. And to realize that there is such a powerful backlash against any sort of meaningful progress, it's been incredibly disheartening to realize that that's the case. But at the same time, it's incredibly important to be aware of that. Maybe that's the woke part, right? It's like people understanding, as much as you can't believe that this is true, that yeah, it really is. It really is true.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Well, we've been talking for a little over half an hour, so we'll wrap it up. But thank you so much for doing this, Andy.
Sure. Happy to do it.
Thank you for listening to Eminent Teachnology. If you like the show, please review, subscribe, and recommend us to your friends and family. We'd love to hear feedback from you as well. You can email us at eminentteachnology@gmail.com. See y'all soon.